And I will hand over to you, Katrina.
Yes, thank you, Martin, and good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. So today for this session, we provided you with the IFRIC update for December and February. And really we did that because we thought that was the best way to sort of bring you up to speed on what the committee has been working on more recently. So what I'll plan to do now is just mention some background to a number of the topics that that I think might be most interesting for you. But then really, Javed and I are very happy to take questions that you might have on any of the topics covered in those updates, or even more generally, just on any activities to support consistent application. So maybe I'll start with the December meeting and specifically with supply chain financing, which of course is getting a lot of attention in the press right at the moment. So in December, the committee finalised an agenda decision on reverse factoring arrangements. And we really hope that agenda decision is helpful in bringing together all of the relevant requirements across a number of different standards relating to supply chain financing arrangements. So what the agenda decision does is that it walks through those requirements, first of all, setting out how you determine whether liabilities that are part of a reverse factoring arrangement are presented as trade and other payables, as other financial liabilities, or as their own line item, separate from other items in the balance sheet. And then it goes on to talk about the cash flow statement and disclosure requirements. Now, there's a couple of things in this agenda decision I just wanted to highlight. The first is presentation on the balance sheet. The agenda decision notes that liabilities that are part of a reverse factoring arrangement will be presented separately when that separate presentation is relevant to an investor's understanding. And the second thing I'll just mention is disclosure about liquidity risk. I think the agenda decision does quite a nice job of explaining how and why liquidity risk arises in these arrangements. So it's really saying the liquidity risk disclosure requirements in IFRS 7 are important. And I think the last thing I'll say on this, actually, I think it's useful to note that this submission is one that came from a rating agency. And so I think it's clear both in getting the submission and also from the feedback we received that really understanding more about these types of arrangements is very much of interest to investors and analysts. So that's supply chain financing. Next, I was going to mention again from the December meeting the classification of debt with covenants as current or non-current. So the board issued amendments to IS1 back in January 2020, so just over a year ago, that clarified how to classify debt and other financial liabilities as current or non-current in particular circumstances. So I think with that as background, you might ask, well, why was the committee discussing this in December? And perhaps especially when the amendments are not actually effective until reporting periods that begin from 2023. And so the reason the committee was discussing it is because actually during 2020 or the second half of 2020, we started to receive an increasing number of questions about how to actually go about reading and applying those new requirements. And in particular, when there were loan agreements with covenants that were required to be tested after the balance sheet date. So we decided, therefore, to ask the committee to discuss three particular fact patterns just to try and provide some clarity to the market about how, you know, the amendments are to be applied. And we thought actually it would be most helpful to discuss that application early and also in public well before the effective date so that preparers would have actually time to consider their loan agreements and any effect of the amendments sort of well in advance of the amendments becoming effective. I think the next question you could have is, well, why discuss these three fact patterns? Well, I think firstly, it's because these fact patterns were really similar to examples that stakeholders had raised with us where they had questions. But I think almost more importantly, we thought that these fact patterns would be good fact patterns to actually sort of illustrate clearly the principles that underlie the new requirements and therefore how the new requirements apply. So the comments period deadline on that tentative agenda decision has passed in the middle of February, and we received a lot of feedback on that tentative agenda decision. It's raised a lot of interest. I think it's fair to say that feedback, to a large extent, does not disagree with the analysis in the tentative agenda decision. I think most respondents are sort of think the analysis is an accurate sort of depiction of the new requirements. But many of the respondents to the tentative agenda decision have raised concerns about the outcomes of applying the new requirements. So that's a topic that the next step is that it's likely to come back to the committee for discussion in April. So next, again from the December meeting, I'm going to talk about cloud computing costs. So back in 2019, the committee published an agenda decision that related to software as a service arrangements. And that agenda decision, as I say, published in 2019, addressed how the customer accounts for fees paid to a supplier for the right to access the supplier's software in the cloud. And in summary, what the committee said then was, well, that right to receive access, that's a service. If the supplier controls the software and the customer obtains only the right to access that software over the contract term, then the customer receives a service over the contract term. It's not receiving an intangible asset. Now, the question that the committee has then discussed recently in December was on the same type of contract, but it asked how the customer accounts for any costs of configuring or customizing the supplier software. So in this case, the facts are such that the supplier controls the software, the customer has access to it, and to benefit from that access, then there's some configuration or customization that needs to be done. And so in December, the committee considered two questions. The first is, does the customer recognize an intangible asset related to the configuration or customization? And secondly, if it doesn't recognize an asset, then when does it recognize the costs as an expense? And I suppose, again, that what you'll see in the December update is that the tentative agenda decision here kind of walks through, again, the relevant requirements in the standards and really kind of sets out, I suppose, what I view as a sort of roadmap for the customer in determining how to account for the costs. So maybe, again, I'll just highlight a couple of points from that agenda or tentative agenda decision. The first is that the committee concluded or noted that often the configuration or customization in this particular fact pattern would not result in the recognition of an intangible asset. And secondly, then, that if there's no intangible asset and the configuration or customization is then a service, well, what paragraph 69 of IS 38 says is that the customer would recognize the costs as an expense when the services are received. And what paragraph 69A of IS 38 goes on to say is that the customer receives the service when those services are performed by a supplier in accordance with a contract to deliver them. So that paragraph 69A is really saying to the customer that it needs to determine when the services are performed by the supplier in accordance with the contract to deliver them. Now, in this particular SaaS arrangement discussed, the customer would actually need to identify the services being received to actually determine when the supplier performs them. And so the question really is there just one service, the service of providing access to configured or customized software, or is there more than one service that could be performed at different times? So is there a configuration or customization service received by the customer that's that's actually separate from the service of receiving access to the supplier software. And in the absence of specific requirements in IS 38 on identifying the services, the customer would refer to IFRS 15's requirements on identifying performance obligations. And it would do that because the committee concluded that those requirements deal with similar and related issues to those faced by the customer in this particular SaaS arrangement. So again, that topic was out for comment. The tentative agenda decision was out for comment. The comment period closed in the middle of February. And the Interpretations Committee will actually discuss this at its meeting next week. So if you are interested, there is actually a staff paper that analyses the comments received on the cloud computing costs that's now available on our website. And so very finally, by the way, last topic I'm going to mention is in the February IFRIC update, and in particular, it's the topic on inventories and the submission the committee received on the identification, on the definition of net realizable value. And the particular question the committee received was on that phrase, costs necessary to make the sale. That's within the definition of net realizable value. So the submitter asked whether an entity can limit those costs to only costs that are incremental to the sale, or must an entity include all costs necessary to make the sale when it's estimating net realizable value. So what the tentative agenda decision says on that is that IS2 does not allow an entity to limit those costs to only those that are incremental. And what the tentative agenda decision also notes is simply that an entity would estimate the costs necessary to make the sale using its judgment, very much considering its specific facts and circumstances. So that, by the way, that final tentative agenda decision on inventories, that one is out for comment at the moment. So if you're interested in that topic, and we would encourage you to comment on it, the comment deadline is the 14th of April. So I think with that, that was all I wanted to highlight in advance. As I said, Javed and I are now very happy to take any questions that you had on anything I talked about or just anything more generally on our activities to support consistent application.
Okay, thanks, Patrina. Anybody wants to comment or ask a question on Murilo?
Thank you. Thank you, Patrina, for your presentation. First, I'd like to congratulate the committee for addressing the classification of debt between current and long-term, non-current, based on covenants. Because it's something that's still going to become effective, and so you are being very diligent in dealing with that before it becomes effective. However, I think I do fall within the category of respondents that were concerned with the effects and the consequences of that specific paragraph that was included within the revision of IS1. And I just wanted to take the opportunity to say that I believe that issue might have to be addressed also by the ISB sometime in the future, because I think the concerns were mostly related to a paragraph that was not submitted for during a comment period and included after the exposure draft was taken from consultation. But the paragraph was not there in the exposure draft, so that's a little bit complicated. And the paragraph, apparently, on the opinion of many, might create some counterintuitive results. So just something that I wanted to point out, that the ISB might have to take a look at that in the future also, besides the committee. Cloud computing, I read the paper, and I might say I'm still struggling a little bit with the idea that these standards should be read as directing the solution to toward IFRS 15, because if we assume that these transactions did exist before IFRS 15 and that an entity would have to apply IAS 38, they would naturally have to come up with an accounting policy for these transactions to account for the recognition of these expenses. So to me, these timing differences between this, the effective dates of these standards, the existence of these standards, should be somehow evidence that that the maybe the wording of the tentative agenda decision should not suggest that the standards should necessarily be written that way, that IFRS 15 should be the alternative that an entity should have used to account for these transactions. I mean, other alternatives should have been valid as well. And regarding inventories, also reading the paper, I felt that one could very easily reach the conclusion that incremental costs should be understood as the type of costs that one would have to use under IAS 2, based on an analogy with IAS 36, which based on what I saw in the paper, there was a presumption that the IASC intended some meaning for the specific paragraphs that we have in IAS 36, but that's a presumption. I mean, we cannot. That's an assumption. We cannot be sure that the actual intention of the board at that date was not to assume that those incremental costs that were mentioned in the IAS 36 should not be used under IAS 2. We also identified guidance within accounting literature in the manual of Big Four auditing firms recommending to use that analogy. So it's also something that I think maybe it's a matter of wording to be used in the agenda decision, not to say that one should clearly not refer to IAS 36, because a lot of people do that.
I mean, if it's helpful, I'm happy just to give you some more thoughts, Marilla. Is that okay?
Yes, please.
Sure. Just a couple of things, by the way. And first of all, thank you very much for that, Marilla, and some of your comments and thoughts, which we note. Just on cloud computing, by the way, I understand what you're saying. I just wanted to be clear, just for anyone else listening, because obviously as part of what I described as well was I did say that the tentative agenda decision as a piece in the walking through of the requirements, by the way, does note that a customer would refer to requirements in IFRS 15. I just wanted to be clear there, the kind of what the tentative agenda decision is saying is, first and foremost, the customer is applying IAS 38. And so the particular requirements, so in the case where there's no intangible asset recognized, so you're treating these costs as a service and you're determining when to recognize that as an expense, you are very much applying IAS 38 and you're applying paragraph 68 to 70. And the only reason in this case, it's only for a piece of the analysis in a sense, where I think that at least the committee tentatively concluded you'd look at 15. And by the way, the other thing I just wanted to emphasize is that we've had some comments back to say, because we in this case say the customer might refer into IFRS 15 in the context of identifying the services, oh, does this mean the customers always have to look to IFRS 15? And are we somehow, changing things very much to start to imply that IFRS 15 has to be applied by customers? And so I just want to emphasize that what our paper goes into detail on is trying to say, look, no, that's not the case. We're not saying customers always have to start to look to IFRS 15 in the absence of specific requirements. it's the reason in this case we are, it's very specifically because of the requirement in IAS 38 and in paragraph 69A that is actually requiring the customer to determine when the supplier has performed in accordance with the contract. So it's the kind of specific facts and circumstances in this case. Number one, the customer is applying IAS 38. It's because it's applying those words in 69A. And it's also because in this particular fact pattern, it's having to think about whether it gets one service or more than one service. So again, I just want to emphasize that hopefully we're not telling people they always have to go to IFRS 15. It's because of the particular circumstances in this fact pattern. And then maybe just one other thought, Marilla, as well, around your comments on IS2. Again, the point that you picked up about how I think some people perhaps in the past have been analogizing to looking at the wording in IS 36 and said the definition of cost of disposal in IS 36 in the past when they've been applying IS2. We certainly, the staff paper and that did do some analysis in that. And I suppose as a starting point, and from our perspective, yeah, we felt that this wasn't a situation where you could analyze to these other standards because there are actually requirements in IS2. So you're not going to the IS 8 hierarchy here. There are requirements in IS 2 that tell you that you need to be determining the cost necessary to make the sale. And obviously, because IS 2 doesn't mention the word incremental and there are requirements there, at least our perspective was we felt that there wasn't a basis to go and sort of pick up requirements in another standard when you're applying what's in IS 2.
Okay, thanks, Petrina. We have in the chat, Srinath asked if you are also prepared to receive a comment on the ED lease liability in Israel and leaseback. And I think you're happy to receive questions.
Obviously, and especially when it's on my favorite standard, IFRS 16.
That is what I thought.
Thank you for allowing me to bring it up, this matter, even though it is not in the agenda. I thought it is more appropriate because the due date for comments is closing on 29th March. As indicated in the exposure draft, one of the alternative view expressed by Ms. Francois Flores as a dissent on this approach, I would fully support the view expressed by one of the dissent member here. In our case, we have a sale and lease back arrangement from one subsidiary to another subsidiary, intermediary subsidiary. So in the application of this, by looking at the proposed amendment to IFRS 16 as indicated in this exposure draft, I feel it difficult to comprehend the change in definition of lease liability compared to the original IFRS 16 lease standard, wherein we ignore variable lease payments while recognizing the lease liability, whereas this amendment proposes a change in definition when it comes to lease liability in a sale and lease back, wherein you need to consider the variable lease payment as well. So that brings some inconsistency on our balance sheet, especially in the group consolidation. This will get eliminated, but when we look at one of the subsidiary which does this lease sale and lease back transaction within the group entities, so we feel that this brings more inconsistencies in the presentation of lease liability on the balance sheet. I'm not sure if other members agree with the proposed amendment, but what I have seen based on the comments what you have received already on your website, I feel most of the submitters have disagreed with this approach. I don't know how you want to take it further.
Do any other members want to comment? Or otherwise, I'm happy to make a comment.
I think Marilo has it.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I support the comments made regarding the exposure draft. I also feel that including variable payments might create a situation in which we may have to recognize liabilities that aren't exactly liabilities according to the framework, since especially in cases in which we do have these variable payments connected to performance or usage. So it it could be under the control of the lessee to determine whether he or she will pay these variable payments. And accordingly, we might not have a liability in that circumstance. Also, I think it's also very problematic to have different measurement basis for lease liabilities that are originated from leasebacks and lease liabilities that are not. It's essentially that. I do support the comments made here.
Okay, Patrina, do you want to respond to that?
Yes, no, thank you. By the way, thank you both for bringing it up. As you note, this is an exposure draft that's out for comment till the end of the month. And you're right to say, I think we've started to get some comment letters that are on our website. Clearly, by the way, we will look very closely and consider very closely all comments that we receive. Just again, only if it's helpful in terms of explanation. So, you know, I understand the comments raised today. I think you're right to say it already some of those comments are coming through in some comment letters. But I just wanted to emphasize for you, explain a bit more the context within which the board made this, what is a narrow scope amendment, by the way. So when the board came along and looked at this, as I say, narrow scope amendment, this issue to do with sale and leaseback requirements, it has kept itself within the remit of, first of all, and importantly, and I'll make it clear, not changing any of the principles requirements that are underlying what you do for standalone leases, you know, for leases outside of a sale and leaseback. It's not touching that at all. It's only looking at the sale and leaseback requirements, but also, by the way, not changing the kind of underlying principle that the board developed for sale and leaseback requirements when they developed IFRS 16. So just to say, Murillo, I understand your comment about saying, you know, you question whether it's useful or best in a sense to have lease liabilities arising from sale and leasebacks being measured differently to say lease liabilities arising from standalone leases. But I suppose what I would just emphasize is that difference between the accounting for standalone leases versus sale and leaseback, the assets and liabilities that arise from sale and leasebacks, that difference is not created by this exposure draft. That was actually created by the board when they developed IFRS 16. So when the board developed those principles in IFRS 16, it very clearly had in mind that the accounting for sale and leasebacks would be different from the accounting for standalone leases. So I just wanted to emphasize that to make it clear that this exposure draft is not creating that difference. It's simply the board sort of were keeping themselves within what was already in IFRS 16 and then trying to fill the gap in a sense where IFRS 16 itself didn't have any subsequent measurement requirements.
Okay, thanks for explanation, Patrina. Murillo, you want to reply?
Yes, just to make sure if I understood correctly, because the idea that I had about the application of the requirements for sale leasebacks under IFRS 16 was that it should create a difference between the measurement basis for right of use assets. But I didn't originally understood that it should necessarily create a difference between the measurement basis of lease liabilities, which is now, in my perspective, now being created. And that's what's concerning me, because there is the idea that lease liabilities on those sales bags should depend on the measurement of the right of use assets, which I was always understanding that should be the opposite, and that's what concerns me.
Yeah, no, and I understand, Murillo, because I think that what you're rightly highlighting is that And that's almost, by the way, part of the reason the board's doing this exposure draft is at the minute in IFRS 16 within the sale and leaseback requirements, it very clearly addresses the measurement of the right of use asset, very clearly specifies the gain or loss to be recognised on the transaction, but there aren't actually any specific requirements within the sale and leaseback section on the liability. And that almost feeds into your point that said almost from reading just what's in IFRS 16 already on sale and leaseback, it wasn't necessarily clear the effects on the liability. And I suppose it's only when this project of the board sort of came via question coming to the interpretations committee and what, you know, was made sort of clear, I suppose, through the committee's discussion of that is that in order to be compliant, in a sense, to apply and meet the requirements in IFRS 16 for the measurement of the asset, which is done on sort of a proportionate basis, it's a portion of the previous carrying amount. So in order to be able to apply IFRS 16 and to meet those requirements on how you measure the right of use asset and how you recognise the gain, that consequentially, in a sense, means that the measurement of the liability is linked in a sense and depends on the measurement of the asset. But I agree with you that I think that, as I say, it's almost part of the reason the board is doing this, is to sort of fill that gap at the minute and provide much clearer requirements about that liability measurement.
Thanks, Petrina. Maybe you want to understand you want to make a comment on this IAS 1 current non-current issue, please.
I do, but I think Srina wants.
Yes,
wanted
I
to
just.
Add back.
Yeah, I just wanted to add a comment in my example. We have a right of use asset without lease liability because the lease liability is completely settled in advance. So when sale and lease back happens, we are surprised that because of the variable element, it results in a liability. So that is something, there is an outcome is quite strange when we apply the proposed amendment. So I just wanted to give some examples which may end up with different results.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Mary.
Thanks, Martin. I feel like my role, especially for this, is maybe to give some context, background information about the IS1 amendment. You know, about issues, and I was just going to choose to try and do that about IS1 without getting into the specifics of the proposal. It just was that Petrina, when she was talking, was absolutely correct to be referring to the new requirements that the amendment introduced. But one of the things I think we all have to remind ourselves is that the new requirements are actually another narrow scope amendment project that was seeking to clarify a long-standing requirement that's in the standard. And I think the wording that's been there for forever and a day is that the entity has the unconditional right to defer settlement for at least 12 months. So when we are talking about, you know, the new requirements and how you apply the new requirements, it's requirements that are clarification, you know, attempting to clarify the pre-existing basic principle that's articulated in IS1. And I just raise that so people remember that it's, you know, in that context that I think the committee will be discussing the feedback that it got to its agenda decision. Petrina, I hope I didn't err in any of that, but I just thought it was stepping back one step might be helpful context.
Oh, very helpful. Thank you, Mary.
Okay, thanks, Mary. I don't see any further requests for a comment or question. Then I would say thank you very much, Petrina Javid, for your contribution. Always a lively discussion.
I'm glad, Martin, nobody asked me about inflation hedge accounting. That was that's a relief.
Okay.
Thank you very much. That was very, sure, very useful to have your input. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, that will bring us to the end of our GPF meeting. And I understand that this meeting is Sandy's last GPF meeting, and I want to take the opportunity to thank you very much.
Thank you. I just wanted to say how grateful I am that I was able to participate in the GPF for as long as I have been able to, and to thank the board and staff member at the ISB for taking the time to listen to the preparers, and also to the preparers. I've learned a lot from the various preparers that we've had on the team over the years, and I appreciate all that. As a comment going forward, I just encourage everybody to try not to create new differences between IFRS and US GAAP, and to continue to consider having a US member on the GPF to provide some input on consistency and perhaps ways to eliminate inconsistencies if possible.
Okay, thank you, Sandrine. And I think we have to say thank, as I said, for all your contributions, your advice, spending a lot of time giving us advice and participating in these GPF discussions, which I also think are very helpful to get to a better and high quality standard. Having said that, I think there is no any further comment request. So thank you very much, all of you, for helping us, spending your time, and giving us advice. Next meeting, I think, is a joint meeting with CMAC, and is scheduled for June. So far, take care, keep healthy, and have a nice day. Thank you very much.
Everyone.
Bye.